John Robb, thanks for joining.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks, John.
I appreciate you taking the time. As I had mentioned before we got started, not to be too gratuitous, but I've followed your work since I read Brave New War I was trying to find my copy, 2009, 2010, fascinating read. And I think in my view was one of the first bold sort of reframings of open source, and what does that do to the asymmetry of power, and what does that do to enable actors who may turn some of these open technologies against modern sort of society and culture. But I think, with your recent writing, I have really, really enjoyed Network Swarms and the ideas that you're putting forward. And I certainly want to give you an opportunity to frame that. I mean, I think what I think is interesting for the audience, for the viewers, and they'll see this in the show notes is, correct me if I'm wrong, John, but you got your start at the U.S. Air Force Academy. You went in then to U.S. Special Ops Command, then decided Yale was the right follow-up after Special Operations, which I think is fascinating. And then I presume took a lot of that and synthesized it into your role as an analyst at Forrester, where you were tracking some of the very earliest internet technologies, and then founded Gomez and had a very significant exit. Was it just shy of $300 million to CompuWare, who, of course, at that time was a massive player. And the Easter egg for me, I have to say, was discovering that you were CEO of Userland Software, which right. I just think was one of the most delightful companies. And, for those who may not know Userland, they certainly know RSS, if they're techie, as I think a lot of listeners will be. And so a brief aside, tell me about Userland Software. How was that?
Yeah. So I was at Forrester in 95 and I got pulled into the internet. They didn't have anyone covering it at the time. And I was a new guy. I'd just been doing tier one special ops and went to Yale to kind of fill in the gaps in my business knowledge. And I was showing that all these new technologies, internet technologies to everybody in the company. And they said, okay, why don't you start that service? And it was like 25% of their revenue after I launched it and started writing these big picture reports. I had a kind of a knack for it. And one of the reports I wrote in 96 was called Personal Broadcast Networks. This idea that we would be posting things and people would be subscribing to them, and that we could create all these personal publish subscribe networks that would constantly keep us up to date on all these other individuals. And everyone at Microsoft and Netscape and others came to me and said, how do we build this? And I go, I don't know yet. But
in
it
fact,
feels like that's
I was at Microsoft on the browser team at that time, trying to get into the the right quadrant. So please go ahead.
Yeah, Mike Homer over when he was before he died was over at Netscape, and he was head of marketing there, and he came to see, he was kind of like, how do we do this? But I went and did Gomez, and we did that exit. I think it was like sold for $295 million was the exit on that. And then in 2001, I had something else I wanted to do, and I wanted to see if I could make this idea real. It was basically social networking. And in 2001, I saw a company that was doing a lot of that called Userland, and Dave Weiner, who was the chief programmer there, and he needed somebody to run his company. And I came in and ran it, and it was like a 3-4 person affair. Robert Scobel was our marketing for a while,
punching way above its weight, though.
Yeah. And we built basically social networking as we know it today. We published RSS as an open source standard. We created a tool that you could subscribe to RSS feeds, and the feed on our tool, we called it Radio, is a desktop tool. I mean, it looked exactly with the same kind of constraint on characters you get in Twitter. So it looked exactly like a Twitter feed, and the publishing, you could take it from Twitter, that Twitter kind of interface, and then publish it into a weblog. And we established a lot of the early standards for how weblogs are published, reverse chronological order, timestamps. You could take what other people you subscribe to and then post more on it. So, and it was actually blue. It looked exactly like Facebook. So that was the default color. I mean, it's exact the Facebook color. So we did that in 2001, and it was too early. I got experience trying to get people to see an emerging technology from the ground floor. And it was excruciating. You know, I saw the things and I told people how to use it and how it could be applied. Spent a couple of hours with Ray Ozzie before he took over Microsoft for a while. Wow. And he was trying to figure out how to, if this is something they wanted to employ, that could have put them in an amazing position if he had taken that in. But I guess I wasn't convincing enough. And we got New York Times to sign on to do an RSS feed and as one of our exclusive feeds for the radio tool. And once they were on, all these other places went on, NPR and everyone else, just wasn't enough. We just ran out of steam and I left before Facebook and Twitter took off. So went on to do other things. It just it was very excruciating to go through. It's hard. People have cognitive filters. They just can't see it. They just couldn't see the value and the dynamism. And I just saw it like it was clear as day. And I saw it, just couldn't communicate that well enough, I guess. But well, anyway, that was my experience.
Being early is an even greater or as great a source of failure as being wrong in startups. And so it is tremendous. I mean, I do though, you know, again, as I said, it delights me to find that you were running Userland. My Mac 2SI, you know, I think I remember is what I had, or a Quadra 950 or whatever. The details are not important, but I distinctly remember that application, that software. And,
you know, it was a cool experience.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, in doing that, and I think, to connect the dots, I raise that because that was an extremely early experiment in, I don't want to strain the word decentralized, but this was pushing, you know, a lot of this to the edge or to the end user. And so, you know, we fast forward now 25 plus years later. I'd love to get into, John, your framing of trust. And again, I'll sort of say, because you have worked in special forces, because you have built and sold a business, you've got two very, very different perspectives. How do you view trust? I know you thought a lot about this.
I mean, trust is a minimum requirement for cohesion. Okay. And cohesion is a minimum requirement for high quality decision making. And cohesion allows you to view the other participants in your decision making process as friendly to that process, that they're not trying to sabotage it. It also works at a national level with political discussion. So if you see somebody with a different opinion that's an opponent, you can argue that, and you could, but you fundamentally trust them in the sense that they're working for the good of the nation to just disagree. But I mean, in the current environment, we see many of the people on the other side of the political spectrum as enemies. They're outside our tribe. And that tribalism, you know, I dug into kind of find the kind of origins of trust is that we were wired at a biological and neural level for tribal life. And life inside a tribe was a high trust environment. You knew everybody there. You were reliant on everybody there to get through the next day, the next year. Their success made you more successful. It was largely a gifting culture, and the culture where you gave things, and better the gift, the more status you had. And then we broke with the tribal culture and started to scale our society, adding more people. And that tribal connection, knowing there was other people, wasn't sufficient then. And we came up with kind of hacks or workarounds to try to make that trust possible. And we came up with a legal system. We came up with bureaucracy being a formalized way of getting things done that operated on a civil code. And there was a certain level of professionalism associated with it. And so you could trust that its output would be high quality. And then we replicated tribalism in the sense by coming up with nationalism. And nationalism gave us that cohesion at the national or nation state level that allowed us to operate as a cohesive unit. And then marketplaces, of course, you know, they have to be fair. You have to make sure that they're not being corrupted or gamed and, you know, that kind of need for, you know, making that process transparent is, you know, behind many of the rules that we see in terms of financial disclosures and things like that, and how contracts work. So we, all of these things that we have are, you know, that we rely on now are workarounds, right? So, you know, that's kind of my thinking on this is that can we use current and currently being developed or technologies to find better ways to do that? Okay. Improve the quality of trust.
That's very, very helpful. And I think, you know, it is interesting to look at all of our technologies, as enamored as some, myself included, may get with them, as attempts to scale trust, attempts to get beyond Dunbar's number, attempts to replicate right. the tribe, as you say. Well, on that note, your work has for a long time highlighted how centralized systems are prone to collapse under pressure. And you've been writing quite a bit, and I know engaged in many energetic discussions on X, on Twitter, about AI. How is AI, in your view, making these weak spots harder to ignore? And what's the clearest sign that we're trusting these centralized systems too much?
Yeah, I mean, a centralized system, like the big tech companies are currently running with social networking and other things. And, you know, social networking now is upstream of the legacy news system and how we actually manage information transfer now and process information. Problem with that is that it can be disrupted and is easily disrupted from the from underneath, but it can also be, another failure mode is that it can be locked down. Right. And one of my big worries back in 2017 was that we were headed towards a potential lockdown of the information ecosystem. And that the tendency of, I call our political factions Blue Network, Red Network. The tendency of the Blue Network after it, you know, kicked Trump out of office in 2020 was to lock down these systems to try to minimize the ability of the opposition to say anything that wasn't approved. And it got support across the industry. And it categorized all violations of these rules as kind of evil and things that caused bans and stuff like that. I'm not trying to, you know, paint them as the bad guys, but they saw it as a need for stability. And this was, it needed to eliminate misinformation and disinformation. And, the rules were getting applied in more and more instances, both at the technology level with the big companies, as well as at the governmental level and different organizations. I've been writing about AI during the same period since 2017, how it would actually work at when employed. So I was ahead of the game on this, and I saw AI just about to hit. My big fear was that AI would be employed as a means of locking down the entire system, getting into every conversation, managing those conversations, and then controlling them and redirecting them, and, you know, not just simple censorship, but even more. And once that happened, billions of people in real time could be managed. All the topics that were available to think about and talk about would shrink down to a narrow orthodoxy, a narrow group of approved topics,
and then the Overton window.
Yeah. And then, not just Overton, everything that could potentially challenge stability would be wiped out. And that means all innovation dies. Your ability to actually push back against the establishment or how things were operating dies. Your ability to adapt to changing conditions and everything else would die. I mean, from perspective of somebody who studied like totalitarian states, I mean, it was like these corporations were building essentially a totalitarian state in a box, because all you needed to do is turn it on, and they could do it cheaply. They didn't need massive bureaucracies of people like they had the Stasi had, of going through everybody's emails by hand and that kind of thing. It could all be automated, and that ended with Musk taking over Twitter and unwinding and providing an alternative kind of information conduit that broke open the system.
And now do you think, John, is it that simple? Was his buying Twitter and taking over Twitter that momentous?
100%. I mean, Trump never would have won. I mean, he didn't win in 2020, not because of election fraud or anything. It's because social networking locked him down. His ability to route around the media went to zero. It was shut down on Facebook. It was shut down on Twitter. It was shut down on all the other places that you would normally get information. And his supporters were sent to the boonies. And we would have seen a repeat of that in 2024, if not for Musk's acquisition of the company. I think from reading his interviews that he was motivated for much the same thing I had had seen, and he saw it too. And he was worried, and the trigger for him and the trigger for me that this was potentially very dangerous was the response to Ukraine. I mean, we've been playing back and forth with Russia, I think with a mistaken policy of NATO expansion, trying to turn a newly democratic country into an enemy. And the guy who came up with containment, George Kennan, said it was a bad idea. But nonetheless, it was a back and forth, and Russia was pushing back against it as we pushed up against their border. And there'd been other conflicts in Ukraine and in other places. And we turned this into using, you know, the network turned it into a new Cold War and pushed us up towards a nuclear confrontation where it didn't, you know, exist. I mean, you could travel to Moscow and take a vacation a year prior to that war. And all of a sudden they were being disconnected by millions of people. Across government and people inside government, inside corporations were taking action on their own to push us towards Cold War, towards confrontation.
Yeah, it felt to me like preemptive and over-compliance. I mean, I won't name a particular company, but I was with one that aggressively over-complied, in my view. And so, to your point.
Yeah, they reframed the whole conflict from regional war and, you know, back and forth that we would normally negotiate our way out of and deal with into, they just escalated it. Like this is like a new Hitler emerging, or anyone who said anything else would be swarmed and stomped on. And that swarming behavior, actually deciding war, you know, whether we're at war or peace, was kind of scary to me. It was unreasonable. The way the swarm operated and was that it saw the enemy as unconstrained evil, and Putin was unconstrained evil because of his support for Trump. You know, which is the seed of it, interfered in our elections, and that he instantly became Hitler, and therefore we had to fight him. And it was a scary moment. There was no nuance, to the whole position of the swarm. There was no negotiation. It was only total victory, collapse of Russia, that kind of thing. So I don't want to go off on the Ukraine thing, but the swarmy behavior was scary to me. And then we've seen swarms with George Floyd and other places that it can't be reasoned with, and it distorts the truth, and it doesn't stop when it should. So
I think that's what's so powerful about that word and what it conjures as compared, say, to a smart mob, a term, used, 15, 20 years ago, maybe, is the swarm is, as you said, it doesn't stop until it has, complete victory. And I'm curious, John, there are, no end of conspiracy theories, but if I take a naive approach, and I look at incentives, what incentivized the emergence of the red and blue swarm and the all-consuming total victory? Are these emergent behaviors, or is there an incentive that drives this?
Well, I've been tracking networked organizations and their emergence, and I saw these networked organizations as potentially another layer of societal decision-making. So we had tribal, which is nationalism in our current context. We had bureaucratic, which was this kind of professional system for mobilizing resources and analyzing information and managing people at scale. And then you had markets for discovering information, for allocating resources based on need. And we combine them in our system of governance by using markets for elections and to elect the leader of the bureaucracy. And that we use nationalism as a way to motivate people to point in the right direction, orient themselves towards, you know, advancing the good of the nation, and then cooperate and provide cohesion in our decision-making as a whole. So we combine those into a useful whole. And all of those developed with the advent of the printing press, and it took 500 years to roll out. And it was a bloody, horrible process of creating these organizations, creating these means of deciding what to do next, and that we arrived on this. And now here comes something new, you know, this networked layer. Networking layer, you know, for decision making. And we saw it in insurgency, we saw it in protest, like Egypt and other places, Tunisia. And then we now see it emerge in politics. And in terms of the red and blue, it emerged in the, you know, the red network that supported Trump, that tried to get him, you know, got him into office the first time in 2016, came out of the blue. Okay. And it became out of the blue because he was challenging the globalist orientation of the current administration and establishment. And, you know, that globalist orientation is like, we made all our decisions as a country pointing towards globalism, and that we minimized nationalism and minimized the kind of system that we were running during the Cold War, where we had to have a strong nation state that was economically independent, that had an eye on prosperity and broad prosperity for everybody, was focused on national defense, you know, rather than defending the world. And we shifted at the end of the Cold War towards a globalist orientation, and all the policies increasingly, the world had flat people and everyone else, you know, started thinking that everything, you know, we didn't need any trade barriers or any kind of economic independence. We didn't need to worry about prosperity. We could open up all of every American to competition in the rest of the world, because that'll make them stronger. And that we didn't deliver on prosperity anymore. And we started de-emphasizing nationalism. And the elites on the whole, from what I saw, and I you know, interact with a ton of them, is that they started to see themselves more and more as globalized, you know, global people. They weren't nationalist anymore. And that that weakened the nation state. And we ended up with a country that didn't really have control over its borders anymore, didn't have a control over its the messaging anymore. You know, the kind of narrative that kept us together and helped us move forward. It was starting to get really messy as the internet started to eat away at it. And we didn't have control over economics and finances because we globalized, and we were making mistake after mistake. Like, for instance, 2000, bringing China into the WTO, because we thought it would democratize them. And then instead, what we ended up doing is creating an opponent, a competitor. We grew them because we didn't go after fair trade. We just opened our borders, opened our trading system to them. So people are kind of fed up with that. If you said, because, you know, what the establishment was saying is that whenever you mentioned focusing on U.S. defense rather than, you know, policing the world with military force, lots of useless wars and the rest, as we saw in Iraq, and toppling governments that caused more misery than they saved us from, like Syria and Libya and other places, as bad as those dictators were, they weren't nearly as bad as the stuff that came after. We created ISIS because of that too. So it's like, yeah, we made tons of mistakes. Is that if you said you wanted to focus on U.S. defense, they could say you're an isolationist, and you'd be dismissed from the conversation completely. If you say you wanted fair trade, they'd call you a protectionist. If you said you want self-reliance, you're a protectionist. You were dismissed. And if you wanted a good, you know, control over immigration and borders, you were a racist. Or you were a protectionist because you're not letting these, you know, this flow happen. So that restriction of the dialogue and the increasing number of failures we saw, like with the financial crisis and the failure to, you know, punish anyone for that and everything else, created this great well of discontent with the globalist orientation. And Trump tapped into it, and it put him into the White House because they knew that he would disrupt things. They weren't electing him as a candidate. They ran a open source insurgency. It was dynamic. It wasn't run by him. You know, it was run by places like The Donald on Reddit. And I was interviewed there like a week before Trump. So it's like, okay, how did this work? And I explained how it was working for them. And places like, you know, even like Anonymous and stuff took a lot of my writing. And that was the founders used that to found it. This kind of open source opposition to the establishment emerged. And it was our first taste of kind of networked politics.
And so these swarms, it sounds like, emerged.
Swarm was kind of a later thing. It's more of an insurgency. Open source insurgency works like very much like open source software. So it has a single goal that kind of unites everybody. And they have all different reasons for motivations for joining it. I mean, there's no barriers to entry, so they can join, they can contribute. And if the contribution works in terms of, you know, memes or some kind of information attack or defense, and it works, people copy it. And then Trump was very good at kind of interacting with that and pulling that out. It's very innovative. I mean, you know, open source insurgency, open source politics, it was extraordinarily innovative, but it had one fatal flaw, is that once you achieve the objective, the open source organization falls apart. Okay. I mean, no one can agree exactly what he should do once we got this grenade into office. And it fell apart. And he was basically left there alone for 4 years to basically, you know, swim against a tidal wave of opposition from the establishment.
And here we are. That, go ahead, please.
No, part of that opposition was the formation of a blue network. And the blue network worked different than the open source insurgency. It waged moral warfare. And the moral warfare is often a feature of guerrilla warfare. What you want to do is you want to make the opponent look immoral and not worthy of any legitimacy, shouldn't be in office. And they founded that based on a opposition to known evils: racism, sexism, colonialism, anti-Semitism, that kind of stuff, all those things that they hated. They formed a kind of tribal trust layer based on that. So they if you're opposed to these, then you are part of their tribe. And anyone who sees examples of those, you would have empathy evoked from those examples. And that bonded you, kind of a network tribal kinship with these other players. So if you saw George Floyd, for instance, with the knee on his neck, and you hated the officer for doing that, your outrage would bind you with not just George Floyd, but everyone else who's outraged by it. And your enemy would, you know, your enemy would be the police officer, and everyone else's enemies would be the police officer in the system that he represented. So many different kind of opinions on how things should work and attacks from everywhere, kind of a maneuver warfare. Within the blue tribe, it was a cohesive pattern of morality. So they parsed all the news at a kind of grand co-curated scale where everyone took every bit of news and spun it. You know, and we live in a kind of a packetized news environment, and everything's broken down to very small bits, and everything was actually parsed and spun and put into a context that, so if you saw X happen, then you would say, okay, this happened because of racism, or this happened because of sexism, or this, you know, the response is colonialist, and that response is anti-Semitic, and that all happened in real time, and it created this huge pattern that everyone was supportive of. And it grew large enough that it had influence, and it aligned corporations and government with that pattern. And that was used as a means of enforcement for limiting the conversation on these platforms.
And so it sounds like, if I hear you, this is fascinating. The blue swarm learned, in effect, from the failure of the red swarm, in that, as you said, once it achieved its goal, it dissolved. There was no cohesion. And right. So in filtering everything as, you know, either for or anti the swarm's identity, then it overcomes the short of the version of the swarm that came before it. And right. Then it sounds like connecting the dots, Twitter, Meta, all the companies that enacted and conducted all of this, in my view, egregious censorship and other behavior, what did they see and what were they capitalizing on?
Okay, so the Blue Swarm drew its members from academia, from government, you know, from big corporations, from the tech crowd. They formed a cohesive unit. They created a kind of a reverse tribalism. So tribalism, the oldest way, of course, to create trust, like I said at the start, is that it's usually formed based on a positive narrative, why we came together, what we've overcome and where we're going in the future. That creates a kind of fictive blood kinship, meaning that you're not actually related to these people directly. They're not part of your immediate family or extended family, but you are, they're members of your tribe and you are connected with them at a deep level. Instead of positive narratives, they worked on negative narratives. It is what you are against, right? So it created a very aggressive, combative kind of mindset. And it also had a big flaw. So when the Blue Network won the White House with a guy that didn't even campaign, I mean, Biden mailed it in. I mean, he didn't do anything. And he was brought into the White House based on the Blue Network's kind of coercion of these big companies into a, you know, strict alignment and employ, you know, alignment with their view of the world. They started really pushing to try to squeeze out the political opposition completely. And they also had an inability to police excessive use of their way of looking at the world. They couldn't say no. When somebody applied that morality, that moral structure, saying, you know, any opposition to what I do, if it's in opposition to this, you know, prohibited activity, this evil activity, it's okay. And so you ended up, normally it would be like, okay, I'm just take trans, for instance, putting men in sports. And, you know, is, whether you agree or not on agree on the issue, it was highly unpopular. And surgeries for kids, again, lightning rod. It proved unpopular, even though they pushed it out and it was being rolled out at a mass scale. Not to pick on trends or anything, but that was just like an example of its inability to actually police the excesses that would cause, you know, widespread resentment. DEI policies and things like that, where, you know, hiring of, you know, certain subgroups was prohibited in favor of other groups. And of course, that created more and more resentment. It wasn't rolled out with any kind of nuance and subtlety and insight into the viability of it. That generated all this negative resentment, and it was unlocked with Musk acquiring Twitter and turning it into X. And it was then marshaled by, instead of a bunch of, you know, millions of individuals like an open source insurgency in 2016, it was marshaled by these bigger professional accounts. Hundreds of these accounts, hundreds of millions of followers collectively, like a Musk with a couple hundred million followers, and they challenged establishment narratives, basically Blue Network narratives. Question DEI, question immigration, question this and this and this. It started poking holes in their narratives, and people followed it. People signed on to it, and revitalized Red Network emerged. And it had, you know, the Blue Network was, you know, being taken apart piece by piece by piece by these, you know, Red Network accounts, and it was increasingly hard for them to actually, you know, get their message across. And they lost the White House. I guess maybe the final step on them falling apart is one of the founding, the Gaza incident caused a huge rift, is that one of the founding factions within the Blue Network is this opposition to anti-Semitism that ran afoul of those, you know, opposing colonialism, fascism, and racism. And it was irreconcilable. That split the network in what I usually what you call is non-cooperative centers of gravity, is that when waging moral warfare, if you want to break the opponent into non-cooperative centers of gravity where there are different groups within the opposition that would fight each other over moral issues. I don't trust you. I don't, that kind of thing. So that was the final nail. Red Network won, put Trump in the White House, but it didn't go away this time. The big accounts took over, and they served as the most of the cabinet positions. They were the ones that were selecting a lot of the people that were going into the senior positions throughout government. You know, the deputies and other things behind, you know, below, they were putting their people in. A lot of those people were tech people, and they did that. And they ran with their narratives. I mean, you know, Musk decided, okay, I'm going to push cutting the budget. He came up with Doge, and he got the green light to do that. Started to trying to account for where all this money was going. Then they, you know, it has more sustainability than the Blue Network, but I think it has many, since it's really kind of early version of network decision making, like the Blue Network was in its last iteration, is that it'll have flaws in its process that will eventually cause it to blow up in the same way the Blue Network blew up. Because right now, the Blue Network, for all intents and purposes, doesn't exist. It doesn't really have any weight anymore. It's got to reform and reformat itself, and it will. And because that moralism is actually quite useful in decision making, because it sets boundaries and standards, but maybe not as, maybe a minimalist approach that might be the better way to get it to grow faster and become more permanent. But yeah, the Red Network that's in control right now will probably suffer the same fate. Right. And, but it's like the evolutionary process. It dies, it comes back better, more evolved. Hopefully not, we don't end up with a version of network decision-making, network politics that is truly disastrous, because we could. You know, it's so strong. I mean, look how it's taken less than 10 years before it took over the whole political system.
And that to me is what's so awe-inspiring and terrifying about it, is the ability to simply be washed downstream, you know, and or carried off with the swarm, whatever metaphor we choose. And I think, you know, with that as the backdrop, here we are in just a few years, we have the ability to manipulate information using LLMs, AI, deepfakes are trivial, automated propaganda. You know, it has to be rewiring how we decide it is, rewiring how we decide what's real. How do you see this shifting the way we choose to trust institutions and each other?
Yeah. Well, having two networks looking at the news tends to keep it more honest. So you'll have a built-in questioning of a piece of news or an item or event that favors the other side, particularly if it can be manipulated. And there are people out, you know, constantly looking at that. Looking at for fabrication and misinformation, and they'll call people out on it. So I don't see disinformation or misinformation as a problem to the extent that we had prior to during the 6 years or 7 years prior to this last election. And everyone was crying about it and mad about it. But that was largely just an excuse for cracking down on stuff and controlling stuff and controlling political outcomes using social networking and information flow. So,
and do you see, and I hear you, and that, you know, that's what's echoing in the back of my head. It seems to me the very boogeyman that was called out, as you said, 4 or 5 years ago, is now in some of these deepfakes or just simply AI generated video, indistinguishable or rapidly approaching 6 months, 12 months, indistinguishable from reality. So do you discern or would you still say that it is not a serious concern?
I don't see the shared information environment under that much threat from that kind of attack or that kind of development. I see it more of a threat at the individual level, because we're really, really close to AI-generated AR, augmented reality. And when that hits, it becomes easy. Well, you're immersed in a visual and auditory environment that's completely AI-generated. The disconnection that will happen at the individual level is insane. I mean, we're already, you know, suffering kind of a societal collapse at one level. I wrote a report on the fertility collapse at the global level that just... this year, it was the first year that global fertility fell below replacement. And the information is just, you know, the numbers are just catching up with that, you know, effect, and it's falling really fast. I mean, you can get down to, say, 1.3 4.6, I think it was the lowest level I saw in South Korea, the most wired nation on earth, right? 0.6 is one child for every four women. That's a way to kind of totally collapse the global population, and no one seems to be able to do anything. It's too complex already because there's so many factors influencing it, and it's obviously a sign of deep dysfunction and how our society is functioning. And now we're about to throw this AR on top of it, where you could have the most trusted people in your life are not even real, right? I mean, you could see them and hear them, and they'll be with you constantly, and they'll talk to you, not only, you know, just confidants and advisors and educators romantic, you know, connections. These people are going to be, these fake people are going to be, these fake worlds that are created are going to be just so much better than real life.
And without moralizing as to whether that's good, bad, or neutral, what do you think is necessary for individuals? You know, I think about still, and certainly historically, the gap, at least in the U.S., as to media literacy and the ability to critically think about media. And now, how does one critically think about this immersive bubble that they live in where everything reinforces their views? You know, do you have a position, John, on what's necessary to get through this next phase?
Oh, well, reality distortion field.
Yes.
There's the kind of political tribalism, you know, is part of that solution, this networked layer on how we think about politics and how we parse it. If you want other people to talk to, you have to, you know, pick a faction, pick a tribe, you know, red or blue network tribe. And
two is sufficient, you think?
Well, two.
Better than one.
Seems to work within our context of our society. I think what happens is if you get below two, or you go to three, or you go to four, is that the dominant party will walk away with it. It's kind of like that Metcalfe's law, right? A network that's, you know, 50% larger isn't just 50% valuable. It's many times more valuable. And it tends to concentrate power in the hands of that larger network. I think the reason why I like the idea of having more information flow, even if it's painful, even if it's largely wrong, even if you have flat earthers out there, you know, arguing nonsense, or people coming up with incredibly stupid things and pushing them, is that you have to have that openness in order to solve complex challenges. We live in a complex world now, not a complicated world. Complicated world is, you know, it's something you could solve using bureaucracy and planning. In a complex world, you get hit with all sorts of things that you don't have a clue how to solve. Okay. You actually just have to throw things at it, ideas, and see what works. And then when you find the thing that works, then you reinforce it. You can't solve those problems if you have a structured information environment where everything's like limited. You have to have a free flow. You don't know where the new idea that's going to save everybody will come from.
And that's a great, I think, pivot to or shift to. We've talked quite a bit about the individual. On that note, you know, you've warned about AI throwing supply chains and brands into chaos, and I think we can extrapolate from our conversation so far. But to go a bit deeper, what can organizations do to become more resilient to these changes? If the consumer, you know, from the standpoint of a business or a brand, are these highly tribal, swarm-oriented, AR-immersed, individuals, how do organizations need to think about that?
Yeah, it's going to be a problem for organizations, because I did a report on the global, Edelman's got a global trust survey.
Yes, familiar.
You know, Microsoft's old PR agency.
Absolutely.
They found that in every country, every developed country, corporations are more trusted than the government.
Every
country. By a long shot.
And that's a recent, is it?
Yeah. I have a report on that. So you can dig back in the Substack and pull that out.
I will.
And it's basically saying that people wanted corporations to do what the government isn't doing and take control. And that people would not associate with a company that was aligned with one of the opposing political factions. but they wanted them to get involved anyway. So it was just a weird thing is that, okay, here they want these corporations to kind of solve the bigger problems that governments aren't solving, which is all these big global problems in terms of, you know, everything from climate to, you know, economic justice to other things, but also kind of weigh in at the domestic level. So corporations are being asked to align with one network or the other political network. And we can see that it turns out to be disastrous, everything from, you know, Miller Lite to Tesla, right? So everyone who aligns too strongly with one network is attacked by the other. Yet they're being asked and expected to kind of weigh in and do things. In terms of AI, I mean, the way corporations are going to have to, you know, in order to participate is they're going to be collecting data on everybody in their company. They, you know, that's how they're going to build those internal AIs necessary to kind of automate the cognitive capabilities necessary to grow and scale.
And you're talking about, John, if I understand you, employees, not necessarily customers.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, they'll suck their employees dry of data, inevitably. I was trying to push at the Senate a couple of years ago, trying to get people to adopt a data ownership policy, so that we would own our own data, everything we put up. And that would allow us to have a say in, just before AI hit, I think it was 2020, I would say, and just before AI hit, and I was saying, okay, this data is the most important thing in the world. If you want to have a participatory economy where everyone's boats rise and there's, you know, limits and controls over, you know, what gets developed, give people ownership of the data, let them have a say and generate either income or exercise control over how it's used. And then you have a stake, an equity stake, a good, you know, one of those positive equity stakes in these AIs that are being developed, which will become the most valuable technological artifacts ever created. And they, you know, said, of course, didn't believe AI was real at the time, so they kind of blew it off. And now we're in this situation where everybody's going to be sucked dry of their data, strip mined. It's kind of like it's worse than feudalism. Because feudalism was that the feudal lords owned all the land. And it still kind of persists in England to a certain extent today, and that serfs would work that land, and they would be obligated to pay off a certain amount of product. Mm-hmm. And so there was never any motivation for them to do any more. But they were obliged to give them the produce, and in exchange, they were allowed to live on that land, take the access for themselves, and get some level of security. But in this kind of feudalism, we're sucked dry of our data to build these amazingly valuable artifacts. And there's no real reciprocal thing other than you get to use them sometime, right? And you actually even have to pay us to use them. At a corporate level.
Go ahead.
No, just at a company level, it's going to be really tough because Screenwriters Guild kind of got into this early and they kind of set up some barriers, but most corporations are just sucking their employees dry of all their emails, all their utterances inside the corporate setting, every work product. And that's going to be fed into AIs to, it's not automation in the simple sense where it's not mechanical and it's build cognitive replacements.
Yes.
They can think in complex and ways, and handle a difficult exceptions. Because you know how the standard thing is, like 80% of all corporate problems are that take up 80% of the time are non-standard tasks. It's easy to automate the bottom 20% mm-hmm. because you can build something to do that. But if AI is going to take that all over, right?
So the incentive for a given corporation to be able to tackle that is immense. I did some work in 2020 on personal data ownership, legal ownership, and technological sort of containerization, if you will. And
yep.
I want to be more bullish, but you know, what we learned was that most individuals would, you know, give away all their personal data for a free slice of pizza. And so, you know, it sounds like, John, you don't see a lot of bright sunshiny days coming in that regard, but is there hope? Is there, do you see anything on the horizon that would address personal data ownership and would balance power in that regard to some degree?
No. And so it's not just your demographics. Most people, when I say data, they think, oh, just your demographic data and some preference information. I'm talking,
gone.
You know, how you blink your eyes, and you know, how you move your mouth, well, your tone of your voice, the way you interact with other people. All of that data is being sucked up. because we've seen a strong correlation between the amount of data set, you know, applied to training in AI is directly correlated to its capabilities and intelligence.
A digital twin. I don't know if people are still using that term, but I think that was a term of art for some time.
Yeah, no, these AIs, most of the guys actually working on these AIs come out of this mind model. Yeah, they're trying to create a model of the mind and it replicates an individual human mind unconstrained by our biological limits. And the mistake was, they came up with a way to kind of reverse engineer it and kind of approximate a mind model by gathering all the social data, all this output, and then creating a model of that, and then trying to make it act more like a single mind, right? It's always kind of approximation. But the social model that we call LLMs and all this other stuff is actually more interesting as a social model than a mind model. Because it contains all of these different perspectives. I was writing fiction with this stuff. I can tease out the perspective of an Italian mother in New York sitting in the 50s, and it will respond and think like that if you because there's literature and thinking that reflects that inside that meta model.
Yes. I mean, I know you're very fond, as I am, maybe fond's not the word, you're experiencing the benefits of Grok as compared to others. I believe you've posted on that recently, and it is tremendous. Yeah. It's amazing. But as you say, I mean, it's to some degree, you know, a deal with the devil. So you've got, this blended military and tech background. You've seen systems fail up close, sort of across mm-hmm. the spectrum. For those leaders who are facing this AI-driven future, who are looking to collect it all, perhaps with their employees more than their customers, what do failure modes look like? What should they be aware of? What's the cautionary tale to doing this?
Okay.
Or is it just, the incentives are there and they're going to do it?
Yeah, don't let other third parties suck all your data out. All right. And control that and limit your use of third parties to actually crunch it and create virtual employees. Optimally, if you do create virtual employees, is that you should do that on an open source AI platform and is as independently as possible, and that you have complete control of the data. If you have, you want to, build up employee trust and get them, working with these AIs, these virtual workers, is that you give them some level of ownership stake in the value of that AI. And that I see that, they're talking about agents now, which was inevitable, AI agents. And that's, I've been through that since 20 years or 25 years ago.
We were doing it at Microsoft in the 90s.
Yeah, they're redoing that whole thing. What we're really going to look at is social AIs. Okay, social AI is the way it's going to roll out inside the corporation, inside our daily lives, inside of small companies and big companies, is that it's going to be a virtual employee or coworker or educator or advisor, and that you control the data that you put into them. Okay, so if you train them on your preferences or you train them as an employee on a process or a technique, the data that delivered to that AI is not going off to the cloud. It's not being sucked up to the mothership to be used. And that that AI, it won't be flat. It will have a personality. And that it will have a personality that fits the role that they're in, that you like as the person who's working with them. And that it will grow and improve itself based on your interactions, and it will remember those previous interactions. And the best way to do that, of course, was open source, because you control the whole process. So it's these social AIs build trust at the individual level with the other employees, human in particular. They build trust with that human worker that they're working with. They handle complex tasks like they do. It's a partnership. It's not a not running a spreadsheet or something like that. It's not like an automated process in that regard.
Should we trust them? Or are we given no choice?
Well, if you want to compete, sure. I mean, you have to trust them, but you should only trust them if you control that or have an equity stake in the data that you're providing. I mean, if I'm a small company owner, I want it on open source. I want my data sequestered. Because if I create something cool or do something proprietary, I want that to remain within my company. Okay. If I have virtual employees and human employees, I want that knowledge and insight contained to producing, you know, directed to producing value that I can acquire.
Absolutely.
Personality aspects really big in terms of providing, building trust. So, I mean, we have all of these ways of building trust with other human workers, right? Building cohesive teams with other human workers, evaluating performance of other human workers or of human workers in general, what a successful training effort looks like, what all of that onboarding, all that slot is already there for doing, but producing someone that will do the job that's required. The virtual worker from the social AI fits into that slot. It's a natural fit. And so you have to have that personality. You have to have that vector of improvement. You have to have that, interface that allows you to interact with that slot. You know, agents won't do it. Current, like dry Siri type things won't do it. You know, it's too generic, too flat. Those mind models, we're not talking about an AI brainiac. We're talking these AIs only have to be as smart as the person that would be normally filling that role, which we've already achieved for many, many ways. And nice, cooperative, willing to stand their ground on certain issues. All of those things that you would want out of an employee. And we know what those are. And it can change based on the type of company, and you can train for that. You can push for that. To the extent that you don't let the mothership suck it all up, you're better off. And the same is going to be with robotics. You know, robotic and AI you're going to see robots everywhere in 10 years. They'll all be AI run. So if you have physical workers as well as virtual workers, it's the same thing. But you don't want it sucked up to a big company. That data has to remain with you or you're lost. Somebody's going to tap into it, that latent capability, and put you out of a business really quick. So
I find that is, as often as the case, these things are invigorating and unsettling in equal measure. And on that note, perhaps unsettling,
yeah, we're out of time,
hopefully invigorating. I would love to close it up, John. And again, thanks for your time. Yeah. What is one trend vector point on the horizon that you see that you think is going underappreciated that we should all be paying attention to?
Well, the big rollout of social AI is going to catch everyone by surprise.
Define that for me, please.
Well, it's like everyone's focused on cognitive capabilities. You know, pushing the border, cure cancer kind of thing, kind of pushing up to the limits of, what they can do individually. The companies and the individuals are working on trying to make social AIs the voice quality, the emotional content of that, the visuals that will be, folded into augmented reality, the personality. Okay, I've seen people working on personality, but it's like way out of the mainstream, and remembering past interactions and trying to get that memory more cohesive over time. So you're probably running multiple in parallel LLMs, right? To do that, so they can check each other on the responses based on the previous interactions and history. And there's other kind of parallelisms that probably work. So those people are all often la-la land right now, but they're going to become the most dominant. So they're going to catch a lot of people by surprise. And the first ones to employ it successfully are going to make some amazing businesses. So that's going to be a surprise. I don't think anyone's really set up to handle what's going to happen with fertility crisis, because when we finally figure it out 15 years from now and everyone's focused on it, because it's global, you can't, immigration won't solve it. Nothing will solve it. So you're going to have to figure out a way to keep on growing the economy without people. My personal solution to that, and this thing would be the ultimate kind of kicker, is that at some point we'll probably figure out a way to handle the collapse of population associated with the fertility crisis, and it will probably be something that we hate right now, like clonings and things like that, just horrible kind of institutional kind of things, or technology driven things. But how you grow an economy without people is that you give these social AIs the ability to buy as well as produce, purchase. They have a vector of improvement of where they want to go and what they want to do, and their interests will associate with that. As you build that personality out, they can become consumers. And if you have a billion virtual and robotic workers in your economy in 15 years, which is probably a low figure if this thing starts really zooming, because I mean, we went from, in 2007, there were zero smartphones. Okay. Mm-hmm. In 2024, there were 5.3 billion smartphone users. We rewired the whole world in that short period of time. We will have that many virtual workers, if not more, probably closer to trillions. If they start buying, the country that figures that out and gives them the level of autonomy necessary to buy and things, purchase things, become consumers as well as producers, some level of, you know, personal autonomy is going to have the biggest economy in the world by far. Everyone else will be standing still saying they're going to use these AIs as, you know, virtual slaves. Yeah. And they'll always be producing and never taking. But the one that figures out the purchasing cycle would just walk away. I mean, you could see it takes the rest of the world 10 years, 15 years to catch up. Well, it's going to be too late because that first economy will zoom so fast, it'll change everything.
Fascinating. I did not see that coming. I'm thinking of share of wallet. You know, what does that look like when you've got billions of AIs and agents? And
a lot of people think this is a cognitive problem I've seen with people, even with, you know, people who understand economics and finance and stuff, is they tend to think of their personal wealth and ability to aggregate personal wealth, and they don't see any value in making sure that all boats rise. And they don't see that they would be much better off and richer than they are in the most acquisitive kind of scenario that we can imagine if everyone got richer and became more prosperous. So, because the economy would be so much bigger, the whole environment would be so much wealthier and so much more productive and so much more rich in technologies and everything else, is that you know, level would be so much higher that you're starting from, and that it, compared to where you were if you had kind of a few people that were very acquisitive and locked it down, took the majority of what was going on. So they couldn't make the cognitive leap between that kind of slow, turgid environment and this dynamic, massive environment. Another thing is that the other thing I failed at was in 2010 when I came up with a kind of a autonomous corporation concept. This is a couple of years before they had these
DAOs.
Was like 3 years before they came out with DAOs, right? And Bitcoin was just started, and we were trying to figure out a dollar. Right? It was a dollar at the time. How to incorporate it into this, but it was just too early days. And the idea was that we were going to come up with a company written entirely as software that would pay everybody who contributed to that economy, because it was open source, open dynamic, where people could come in, do a piece of work that was measurable by the software, and get paid a certain amount for it, potentially, or just earn equity in that company and all future earnings, like a kind of an annuity in the value that was created. And that I came up with this idea that it would be acquiring like a metadata. So take a picture of every environment, every object, and then label it, because eventually we're going to be using this in AIs, and this data repository would be the biggest data repository in the world for object recognition and that metadata and all sorts of other things that we could have individuals contributing to. And as they accessed it for training these models, making sure that they're not making virtual copies of it so they have infinite training sessions, is that everyone would get paid for that. And the value that would be created could be immense. So for that original hour of work that you made $2 on could become worth hundreds of dollars downstream. And you'd be paid constantly as they grew, as the number of participants was, you know, kept on growing. Of course, it didn't work because there was too many prerequisites for that, like a functional Bitcoin and other things like that.
But wow,
and
you invented Pokemon Go, among other things.
Yeah, well, yeah. But the thing is, that kind of company could have created the ecosystem necessary to kind of challenge it. So if you have this kind of alternative things, they can grow really quickly in this kind of network environment. Just like how quickly network politics have evolved and changed, and the dynamism is shifting in unexpected ways. We could see that's with the economic system as well. I always thought that crypto would be better off within the context of an equity and corporate kind of context, help alleviate some of the elements associated with trust at scale.
And I think that and there's a lot of that emerging. Fascinating, John. I know Global Gorillas is one of your primary focuses and projects. I'll be sure that everyone gets a pointer to your Substack. As I say, I've really, really enjoyed it. I do recommend everybody check it out so we can keep getting these glimpses of what's coming in the future. Thanks so much for your time today, John.
Oh, you're welcome.
Really appreciate it. Talk soon. Yep. Bye-bye.
Yep.